The following podcast is brought to you by the Communication and Media Studies Department at Dominican University, California. I am your host, Mr. Sleep, and welcome to Clawing Through the Mask, the show where I look into the true stories that keep you up at night. Imagine yourself driving on the road in the middle of nowhere, and your car breaks down, and there's no one around you, no gas stations, just the mountains and hills. How would you feel? Would you be scared? Would you be afraid of what's to be out there? Is it afraid of animals, starvation, the elements? Well, when it comes to the 1977 acclaimed horror film, The Hills Have Eyes, those things are nothing compared to what's to be coming. Filmed and directed and written by Wes Craven, the horror film follows a family called the Carters. They're a suburban family targeted by a family of cannibal savages after becoming stranded in the Nevada desert. Searching for a story to film, Craven began looking up terrible things at New York's public library. When going through the library's forensics department, Craven learned about the legend of Swaney Bean, the alleged head of a 48-person Scottish clan responsible for the murder and cannibalization of more than 1,000 people. What's interesting is that Craven, in the legend, what interested Craven was how, after Bean's clan was arrested, they were tortured, quartered, burned, and hanged. Craven saw this treatment of the Bean clan by supposedly civilized people as paralleling the clan's own savagery-like tendencies. Craven decided to base the film on that legend. Before we get into the story of that Swaney Bean, let's just get a quick summary of the plot. The plot is a suburban Carter family is traveling on vacation, towing a trailer en route to Los Angeles. Parents Bob and Ethel are driving, accompanied by their teenage children, Bobby, Brenda, and eldest daughter, Arline. Line's husband, Doug, Line and Doug's baby daughter, Catherine, and the family's dog, Beauty and Beast. This is one big family. In Nevada, they stop at Fred Oasis for fuel, and Fred urges them to stay on the main road as they leave. Fred's truck suddenly explodes, dismissing Fred's warning as a crazy person rambles. The Carters get startled by overhead aircraft when driving near Nellis Air Force Range and skid off the road and crash. The dogs become very panicked and start barking at the hills, which is really weird. Beauty then runs off into the hills chasing after her. Bobby finds her mutilated body. Frightened, he runs, falls, and knocks himself unconscious. Bob walks back to Fred's oasis to get help. As night falls, he finds Fred, who tells him about his son, Jupiter. As a child, Jupiter killed the family's livestock and later murdered his sister. Fred attacked Jupiter with a tire iron and left him in the hills to die. However, Jupiter survived and had children with a depraved alcoholic prostitute known as Mama. Together, they had three sons, Mars, Pluto, and Mercury, and an abused daughter, Ruby. Man, they really love planets. The family led by Papa Jupiter survives by cannibalizing travelers and stealing supplies. Papa Jupiter suddenly crashes through a window, kills Fred with a tire iron, takes Bob prisoner, and crucifies him. Wow. Breda finds Bobby still shaken up about Beauty, and the two return to the trailer. Bobby does not mention Beauty's death to avoid frightening the rest of the family. Pluto sneaks to the trailer and signals Papa Jupiter to set Bob on fire as a distraction. The Carters eventually extinguish the body, the fire, but Bob dies shortly after. Getting to like the end, I don't want to spoil all of it, but the next morning, shortly after Ethel dies, which is Doug sets out to find Kathleen while Papa Jupiter and Pluto set out to kill the remaining family members. Beast tears Pluto's throat out. Brenda and Bobby use Ethel's corpse as a trap to kill Papa Jupiter. Doug gets to the cave where he sees Ruby knocking out Mama and carrying Kathy away. Doug catches up with Rudy, but Mars follows and attacks Doug. Mars gains the upper hand, but Rudy interferes, enabling Doug to overpower him Doug then savagely stabs Mars and continues long after he is dead while Rudy weeps. Getting to that ending, I like how the ending of this little article says savagely. Really calls back to the story and what I'm about to tell you. So, according to Newgate Calendar, a tabloid publication from the 18th and 19th century, we're getting into the lore of the story now. Alexander Bean was born in East Lothian during the 16th century. His father was a ditch digger and hedge trimmer, and Bean was tried taking up with the family trade, but quickly realized that he was not fit for this work. He allegedly left home with allegedly vicious women who appeared sharing his inclinations and was accused of being a witch. After all, but then again, back then, being a witch. After some robbing and cannibalization of one of their victims, a couple ended up at the coastal cave of Benan Head between Griven and Bellatre. The cave was 200 yards deep, and the entrance was blocked by water during high tide, so the couple were able to live there undiscovered for some 25 years. Wow. Sawney and Agnes produced 6 daughters, 8 sons, 14 granddaughters, and 18 grandsons. Wow, and I thought the family from the movie was big. Various grandchildren were products of incest between the children. That makes sense. Lacking the inclination for regular labor, the Bean clan thrived by laying careful ambushes at night to rob and murder individuals or small groups of people. The clan brought the bodies back to their cave where the corpses were dismembered and eaten. The clan discarded body parts, which would sometimes wash up on nearby beaches. This strategy was used to help conceal their crimes and lead villagers to believe that it was an animal who were attacking travelers. The body parts and disappearances did not go unnoticed, though, by the local villagers. But the Bean clan stayed in their cave by day and took their victims at night. As local people began to take notice of the disappearances, several organized searches were launched to find these people because they didn't think it was animals. One search took note of the cave, but people refused to, believing that no person could possibly live in such a bad place. Because there was no foundings, people just started getting hanged. They just started hanging people because they just thought, maybe we'll get them at one point. It wasn't until one fateful night the Bean clan ambushed a married couple riding on a horse, but the man was skilled in combat, thus he definitely held off the clan with sword and pistol. But the Bean clan fatally mauled the wife while she fell to the ground in conflict. Before they could take the resilient husband, a large group of fairgoers appeared on the trail and the Beans fled. The fairgoers took the survivor to the local king and to inform him of what he experienced. The Beans' experience finally revealed it was not long before the king decided to take actions into his own hands. With 400 men and several bloodhounds, they soon found the Bean clan overlooked cave in Benahead thanks to the bloodhounds. Upon entering the cave by torchlight, the searchers found the Bean clan surrounded by human bodies with some body parts hanging. From the wall, barrels filled with limbs and piles of stolen heirlooms and jewelry. So the ending of this story gets really weird because there's two versions of what happens. So I'm just going to read off both. The most common of the two is that the Bean clan was captured alive where they were gave up without a fight. They were taken in chains to the Toll Booth Jail in Edinburgh. They transferred to Lewith, Leith, and Galsgoth, where they were promptly executed without trial as people saw them as subhuman and unfit for one. Sawney and his fellow men had their genitalia cut off and thrown into the fires. Their hands and feet were severed and were allowed to bleed to death. Wow. Sawney's dying words, he said, "It isn't over. It will never be over." After watching the men die, Agnes, for her fellow women and children who tied to stakes and burned alive. These executions practice recalled in essence, if not in detail, the punishments of hanging, drawing, and quartering decree for men convicted of treason. In contrast, though, women convicted of the same were just burnt. This also kind of like ties back to like Salem witch trials where women were just burned. The executions. There was another claim that the search party placed gunpowders at the entrance of the cave where the Sawney Bean faced the fate of suffocation. Wow. So going reading that story, you can kind of really see that why Wes Craven really enjoyed that story, even though it's kind of sadistic, was that the different visions of humanity and cruelty. The people ate people, were cannibals, but just look at how they were treated after. Your genitalia is cut off, hands and feet cut off, and forced to bleed to death, slow and painful death. And then women and children were just burned. Again, a slow and painful death. I did not enjoy this film while watching them, by the way. This was a very hard film to watch when I was doing my research because the film was initially given an X rating by the MPAA due to its graphic violence. Due to this, significant materials was removed from Fred's death scene. The sequence where Mars and Pluto attack the trailer and the last confrontation with Papa Jupiter. Multiple critics had deemed The Hills Have Eyes as cult classic, with Zachary Paul of Bloody Disgusting saying, "In 40 years since the film was released, The Hills Have Eyes has amassed quite the large following. It's hard to throw rocks at any decent horror convention without clocking someone involving with the film's production in the head." Dees Wallace became known as the Scream Queen due to her roles in The Hills Have Eyes, The Howling in 1981, and Cujo in 1983. John Kenneth Murr writes that The Hills Have Eyes was seen as a turning point in the horror genre, an inspiring, humorous, visceral horror film that was accomplished on a technical level, including Halloween of 1978, Friday the 13th of 1980, and of course, Prom Night of the same year. Does The Hills Have Eyes stand up to all these films? I think so. Again, like they are saying, these things were very technical level. They're humorous. I did not see any humor in it. I just wasn't the group supposed to be watching this. And it was accomplished. It was a great film. By box office, it did well. Not many people were kind of like, going back to The Exorcist, not many people wanted it gone. People were fine watching it. There was no lawsuits for this movie that I could find. The film just did well. It was a good film, good horror movie. Apparently, people say it changed horror. I can see it. I can see how it became really gruesome and changed the horror franchise to more gruesome and not about storytelling. Overall, this film did change how I see horror films, especially very bloody ones, in fact. But The Hills Have Eyes did, in fact, change horror, and I will agree with that. Well, this is Mr. Sleep signing off.